This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Now, you've been peppered by poets at different times in the last 2 days, and I'm one of them. Considering the anti-intellectual element in the anti-carbon tax campaign, I see them with placards, screaming at cameras, faces contorted, eyes bulging, fists clenched, eager to be caught for a national audience. And I need to ask, how has this happened? How have these Australians allowed themselves to be turned into an hysterical mob? Did we let this begin to happen when academics justified segregation in the binary secondary school system? Did we help this to happen when students were labelled early for this or that future? Did it begin when science and mathematics became prestigious for a separate academic elite? Did we encourage it to happen when history and literature were dismissed by men as soft, suitable for girls who did not need to face the demands of hard subjects with their intellectual rigour? Did we discourage learning when we sneered and jeered at children who made errors? And have we made it worse when fear of a lowered NAPLAN mark results in children kept at home? If we did, if we have, does this explain the ease with which mining giants subvert, undermine the evidence? Unscrupulous politicians feed fear, well aware this nation has no law demanding honesty in political debate. Politicians can wear their shiny hard hats, pretend mateship, put on the garb of workmen, try with their soft hands to use a trowel. But to see that website, on that banner, on that platform, that spurious website, Galileo's Movement, tells me there are no depths to which these peddlers of fear will not sink.
Thank you, Erica Jolly. So that was fantastic, Erica. Her poems have been published in journals and the Friendly Street publications. Her latest book was launched by Robin Williams at the State Library in 2010, is Challenging the Divide, Approaches to Science and Poetry, in which scientists, including Peter Doherty, reveal their views of poetry, and a number of poems provide examples of responses in poetry to aspects of the sciences. Fantastic, thank you again. I'm Karen O'Day. I'm on the program committee of this festival, and I'm from the University of South Australia. So I'd like to welcome you to this last of the concurrent sessions of this fantastic couple of days that we've had. The topic is Unfit for Task. Before I introduce the speaker, a little bit of housekeeping, the usual, make sure you've switched off your mobile phones, because we don't want that kind of interruption during the presentation. However, the festival organisers are quite keen for you to feel free to tweet, and the address is to tweet at Ideas Adelaide. The hashtag is #AFOI. So today's speaker is John Rowles. He's a physical scientist, BSc from the University of Tasmania, PhD Flinders, And he spent time in management of South Australia's working water resources. He worked on the Murray-Darling Basin, and his areas of particular interest were the influence of vegetation clearance on salinity and the impact of climate change on water resources. He's an adjunct senior research fellow at our university, the University of South Australia, at the Barbara Hardy Institute. And he's deputy chair of South Australian branch of the Australian Solar Energy Society. He's an ACF councillor and a contributor to the annual Sustainable House Day. While exploring and collating social science literature on the psychological and other barriers to appropriate resources of climate change. Actually, before you speak, I must also acknowledge today that we're meeting on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains, and I'd like to pay my respects to their elders past and present. But now I'd like to ask you to welcome John Rolls. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Erica, and thank you for coming along to the last session. By way of explanation, yes, I'm a physical scientist. I've been interested in climate change for a long time, and I've been increasingly concerned about it. What I've been exploring over the last two or three years is the question, why is it that it is so difficult for society to come to address the question of climate change and indeed other issues of similar gravity? And in order to do that, I've been exploring not what I regard as the obvious reasons, like our existing commitment to the use of fossil fuels, but to go a little deeper than that. Of course, under those obvious reasons, there are the power that our present structures give the corporations who own the fossil fuel industry to influence government decisions. All of those I regard as obvious. There has to be, for me, there has to be a deeper reason for why, given the scale of my understanding of the issue of climate change, the scale and imminence of that issue, there has to be a deeper question about why we fail to address it. So among the issues that I see as making it difficult are those you see listed above. I think our politicians have an inappropriate skill set. I think that government is run according to agency silos that don't talk to one another. We've got disciplinary silos within universities, and we've got problems which are psychological and socio-political, which are in fact going to be the essence of what I'm going to talk about. Just by way of example, I think that Australia has failed pretty dismally in the management of large-scale resource problems, and illustrate that by those you see there. Remember the fracturous old-growth forest dispute, the current carbon tax dispute, and only a few months ago we had within South Australia a fairly impassioned dispute over marine conservation areas, which is in fact still going on. Now, what I would assert is part of the problem, and I'm not going to dwell on this, is that our parliamentarians have a very narrow skill set. They come on both sides largely, and most of you are already aware of this, they come largely from a narrow defined set of backgrounds, either in unions or within the apparatus of the Labor Party or the Liberal Party, and they have a very narrow distribution of basic qualifications. One third of the outgoing parliament, that's collecting together the upper and lower house, were lawyers. Lawyers do not represent, one in three Australian voters is not a lawyer. You may not have noticed. So in terms of our psychosocial limitations, I would point to those. We've got cognitive bias. We're all basically Dr. Pangloss. What I mean about when I say that, I mean that all of us see our own life chances as greater than average. All of us, when we apply for a job, think we've got a better than average chance of succeeding in that application. All of us think that we're going to do better in terms of our relationships than average. But of course, we can't all be above average. Another of these biases is that we tend to regard it as more likely that distant others will be affected by whatever problem might be out there, including climate change. It's all the distribution is always away from us so as to make ourselves feel more comfortable. I'll go back a moment. I'll spend most of my time talking about cross-society differences in perception of risk and a little about the last two items. In essence, what I'm addressing is this conundrum, namely, which is illustrated in that table, which shows the difference in belief in what should be an objective reality, whether or not climate change is caused by human activities. The science is in 97% plus of climate scientists agree that overwhelmingly what we're seeing in terms of climate change is due to pollution from human causes or activities. But despite that, in the US, whereas 74% of them believe that that's so, only 28% of Republicans. How can there be such a large distance in perception about a reality? Similarly, when you look at the opposite proposal, namely that climate change is not caused by human agency, the ratio is even more dramatic. So we'll be exploring basically that conundrum. And not much work has been done in Australia on this. Some has, and I will give you some references to that. Most of it's been done in the US, a lot of it at the Yale University. I'll first deal with some work which is essentially a market segmentation analysis. What that means is that the workers carried out a whole series of questions or used a questionnaire in order to gain a great deal of information, both about people's socio-demographic features and their beliefs about climate change. And then they segmented that population on the basis of their beliefs about climate change, and then had a look at what that revealed in terms of the other aspects of their behaviour and beliefs. In the other case, it was based on a theoretical foundation, and I'll address that when we get there. Okay, so this work by Andrew Lizerowitz and his cohort, which it basically describes the population and how they were broken up on account of this segmentation in terms of belief about climate change. And there we have the particular question about their level of concern on a scale of 1 to 4, or in fact it was 0 to 4, but anyway, 1 to 4, as it's shown there. And the orange line says, we believe that climate change is happening, and the green one is about how worried people are about climate change happening. But the important thing is that when you break the population up in terms of this question of whether or not people are either alarmed through dismissive, then you see this large range of characteristics. Similarly, in this graph, where the question is the degree of threat to people, people, again, are just showing a similar gradation across that profile. Within that, because you've got four curves there, and this illustrates the point I was talking about earlier, namely that people's perception of the level of threat to their family, to themselves or their family, is for all groups lower than their perception of threat, for instance, in other countries, shown by the yellow line. Again, this is a similar thing, but where we're talking about the question of the immediacy of the threat. Exactly the same profile. But that's to be expected because that was the basis of the market segmentation. Now we'll look at the other aspects of the socio-demographic analysis. What it shows you, quite surprisingly, perhaps, is that these different groups, despite their radically different perception of climate change, are not all that different in terms of some of these issues. In terms of their support for a local group or self-help organisation, which is shown in the orange, they're mostly fairly similar, but those who are dismissive about climate change, not many of them are also associated with a local self-help program. The thing which shows the strongest gradation across those groups is that of religious or church attendance or involvement. The more dismissive are far more likely to be heavily involved in church than those who are alarmed about climate change. Just looking at the segmentation of how many of these people are in the community, what we see is that 11% are dismissive, 16% are doubtful that it's going on, 12% are unconcerned, and then we've got these two groups, the dismissive and the doubtful, alarmed and concerned, which are quite large, 19 and 22%. So a lot of Americans are concerned about climate change. Now, comparing their... now what we're looking at is their voting patterns. And what we see, a really quite dramatic correlation. If you are alarmed or concerned about climate change, you're far more likely to vote Democrat than if you are a Republican, whereas if you're dismissive about climate change, then you're going to almost certainly vote Republican. So this analysis indicates there's a very powerful characterisation across the community. In terms of a number of social questions, there's again this very sharp variation on the question whether the world would be a more peaceful place if wealth were more equally divided. Those who are alarmed about climate change are that a high proportion of them think that is the case. Those who are dismissive also dismiss that idea. Similar questions which relate to the social equity yield very similar results. Then they asked about where do these people get their information from in terms of media that they use. The top line is TV. It shows that, generally speaking, this is a fairly weak tendency, that the people who are alarmed or concerned about climate change are more likely or larger users of TV, and those who are dismissive are lower or less likely to use TV as a primary source of news. Interestingly, the bottom line shows radio, and there the dismissive and the doubtful are larger users of radio. And my strong suspicion is that what they're listening to is... Well, anyone got any suggestions about what type of program they might be listening to? Talkback radio. Then in terms of other use of media, he was just focusing on print media. There's quite a strong character, at least within the US, a number of print media are quite strongly associated with political views. The New York Times is regarded as relatively central and left, whereas... I've only used one print media, and we're looking at the other forms of media. And what you see here is that you've got the two curves at the top which intersect. The one, the orange one, is Fox News, and what we find is that the dismissive are high users of Fox News, and those who are concerned are much lower in their use of Fox News, and the opposite tendency in terms of CNN. Sorry about that. And then in terms of policy questions and actual behaviour intentions, people are very consistent. Those who are alarmed or concerned about climate change show these two particular tendencies. They're far more likely to buy profess to be far more likely to buy a fuel-efficient vehicle or to use a bike or public transport than those who are dismissive. Exactly what you would expect, but it's a very strong tendency. And again, in terms of support for policies which relate to this issue, those who are concerned are more likely to favour or to express a public opinion supporting increased taxes on the use of electricity. And if you're dismissive, understandably, you won't. And similarly, you'll be less likely to believe that the car companies should produce fuel-efficient vehicles. Okay, so that's empirical data without any kind of theoretical basis to it. It's pure public opinion survey and analysis. However, psychology has been looking at the question of how people deal with risk for a long time. And there are at least three major strands of theory, the rational weigher theory, which you could say is implicit in the way economists think about society, that people respond to risk in terms of their perception about its the likelihood to impact on their utility, their life chances or whatever. There's the irrational weigher theory, which I like and I think is probably a pretty strong explanation of a lot of people's behaviour. And then there's cultural theory, which has a couple of decades of basis to it, which says that people process information about risk in terms of their perception of the risk that threat poses to the people with whom they identify, their social group. In terms of the work of the group Kahan and his co-workers in Yale, what they found is that when they asked people a whole heap of questions about their perceptions of risk, and again, they ask a whole heap of other questions which relate to demographics. What they find is that the features or the scales which provide the highest degree of explanatory power about people's response to risk are those on the index or the scale from communitarian to individualistic, or from hierarchical to egalitarian. Now, these are beliefs that people have, all of us have, about the way in which society should be organised. You either believe that society should be organised to look after the interests of the community generally, in which case you're a communitarian, or you believe that society should be organised in such a way as to allow individuals to have their individual life chances given the best go. And in terms of the other scale, if you're hierarchical in your belief, then you believe that the offices in society, the goodies of society, power in society, should be organised in terms of highly consistent, structured, persistent ways that all to do with stability and the maintenance of those structures. If you're an egalitarian, you believe that it's the kind of belief that anyone within a democracy, I would have thought, should have been strongly endorsing, because it's all about a belief that we should all have an impact, an equal impact, on the way the society is run. In response to a question about whether or not climate change represents a large risk, however, in terms of those scales, respondents show enormous differences. If you're at the most egalitarian end, you're likely to have 69% of those are likely to believe that climate change poses a high risk. If you're hierarchical, you're right at the hierarchical end, then that likelihood is far lower. That's shown in that graph as a spectrum across the scale, where what we're talking about is deciles of the population across the scale from hierarchical to egalitarian. And it's quite linear dependency across that scale. Then, this is really interesting, because what it is saying is people have beliefs about what scientists believe about climate change, but that that level of belief depends on whether you are a hierarchical individualist or whether you are an egalitarian communitarian. If you are an egalitarian communitarian, then Of that group, 67% believe that the majority of scientists believe that climate change is caused by human beings. On the other hand, if you're a hierarchical individualist, only about 11%. So dramatic differences in belief based on how you believe society should be organised. This is another interesting display. What it's showing is that on the question of whether or not climate change is a risk, and when you're dealing with a population of people who have not been exposed to any arguments about the issue, so the run-of-the-mill people, then they can be regarded as the control over the left-hand end of this graph. And there's not a huge difference in their level of belief, or the level of belief among communitarians and individualists on that question. However, if the question is addressed to this otherwise fairly naive audience about whether climate change exists, and the question is posed in terms of the suggestion that yes, it exists, but it can be fixed by controlling pollution, then the level of belief that climate change is a problem and is caused by human beings increases. That belief in that straight question of whether or not climate change is occurring increases substantially among communitarians, but decreases substantially among individualists. Because in each case, well, particularly in the case of individualists, it is seen the framing of the question in terms of a need to control pollution impinges on the interests of the group that individualists are associated with, namely those who are into production, are into capitalist production and all of that stuff. So it's about the perception of threat to interest influences how you believe about an objective fact. Correspondingly, if the same question, whether you believe in climate change, is posed in terms of a framing that the answer is nuclear power, then the difference between people's level of belief declines. The difference declines. And people who are communitarian suddenly find themselves left believing in the problem if the answer is nuclear power. There's similarly, in terms of scientific literacy, there is a difference in perception. Here what we're saying is that people have a different level of belief in climate change, and within the category of egalitarian communitarians, among those who are who perceive themselves as not having an awful lot of information about a topic, there is a low perception of risk. But among the same egalitarian communitarians, if they regard themselves as having a high level of understanding, their perception of risk increases. And in the case of egalitarian communitarians, then you have the opposite tendency. So one's perception of risk is not only dependent on how you want to construct the world, but also in terms of your perception of your knowledge about the nature of your degree of competence in understanding the issue. This one is similarly interesting and a useful pointer when it comes to the question of how we might communicate risk in a useful way from a policy perspective. And what it shows is that where, again, it's similar to the previous graph, but what it shows you is that the outcome in terms of people's level of belief depends on the person who's delivering the message. And if the person who's delivering the message about climate change is of the same social group, the same interest group as people identify with, then they are more likely to believe in their perception of reality is likely to be more different. Whereas if the argument is presented by someone who seems to be coming from the opposite side of the story, they're more likely the levels of belief converge. So what does it tell us? People's belief in the existence of societal risks is based on their threat to their interests as perceived in terms with consistency of that idea with their own beliefs about how society should be managed, the means proposed to deal with it, whether they identify with the person delivering the message, and the socio-political context. There are some lessons there in terms of how we should use that in a policy sense. One of the important things is we should avoid debates by representatives of competing worldviews because they tend to polarise society. I'll move quickly through cultural cognition theory applies to a whole range of areas, not just climate change. This is a really intriguing thing. There was some work done in London and reported earlier this year. And the experiment was to first ask students whether or not they were more likely to vote right-wing or left-wing. They then put those people into a scanner and looked at different parts of the brain, and what they found was that among those who are left-wing, they are more likely to have an enlarged anterior cingulate cortex, which is associated with resolving conflict. If they were right-wing voters, then they were more likely to have a large amygdala associated with the processing of fear. They then put another group of students into the same scanner
And using the information shown by the scanner about the sizes of those two areas, they found they were able to predict with 75% accuracy the way in which people would vote. Interesting. Now, in terms of how these things reinforce themselves, this group, MacWrite and Dunlap, had a look at public opinion surveys over a period of 10 years in the US, and what they found was that liberals and Democrats were increasingly concerned, their levels of belief in climate change increased over that period, whereas if they were either conservative or Republican, their levels of belief had declined. And that can be interpreted both in terms of what I've been saying before, but also in terms of what's regarded as, within political sociology, referred to as elite queuing. And what that says is, if political elites talk about a particular idea and represent it in a particular way, then those people who identify with that political party will tend to also believe that idea. So what's been going on in the US over the last 10 years is that Republicans have been casting doubt, the elites in the Republican Party have been casting doubt about climate change, and the Democrats have still been concerned about it at the elite level. That's communicated to their voters and changed the belief, changed the perception of this reality by the public. So it's a very powerful indicator of how not to organise society and the way we relate to society if we want to actually deal with a problem of the scale and imminence of climate change. I'll just put those figures up to show that the US is not alone. Similar figures apply here in Australia. They've got radical difference in belief about these matters of fact across the different parties. Similar work's been done in terms of a categorisation over the issue of whether or not people are concerned or otherwise. We'll move quickly on. That's again showing a similar thing, where the categorisation was whether people were reluctant to believe in climate change. And there, again, it's showing the same thing, the same issue that I've pointed out before, that people, again, in Australia in this case, see that it is the risk to them is less than the risk to distant others. We'll skip that one. And again, in Australia, we've had a similar tendency over the last 6 years, 5 years, for people to be polarised in their belief about climate change. And for exactly the same reason, what has the Liberal Party been doing? But essentially saying there's no such thing as climate change, or we shouldn't worry about it. I'll skip on that, but I'll point to this conundrum. There's an issue of social, political, negative feedback. People perceive their own lack of agency. They call on the governments to act. Perceiving the ongoing global degradation as a symptom of a weak government, they become cynical that governments are generally serious about climate change. That undermines their impulse or their belief in its seriousness, and undermines their impulse, our impulse, either to act personally or politically. So we've got a really serious problem here in dealing with our own nature as it affects how we deal with risk. I'll skip on that. And then just thinking again about Australia, we've got highly skilled climate scientists, we've got highly skilled renewable energy scientists, but unfortunately, we don't have nowadays a particularly good capacity in terms of environmental psychology within the universities, or environmental sociology, and we need those skills. I'll close at that point and open to questions.
Thank you very much. Would you like to come down?
Yes.
If you'd like to ask a question, please go to the microphone because the proceedings are being recorded and we'd like to have a very full record of proceedings. And I was interested to see that the polarisation didn't seem to me to be as bad in Australia as in the United States. I mean, the political parties, but some of the other factors that you... it isn't quite as extreme. But what's your comment on that?
Okay, you're absolutely right in terms of the figures which are shown there. And in fact, my interpretation is that the US is a standout country on this issue because of the way society is structured in the US. You've got this extreme polarisation of wealth, that extreme differences across society. And I think it's entirely understandable in those terms. And you've also got very polarised media, which tend to feed this.
Now, do you have similar data from a country like, say, Japan, which is an affluent society, and probably pre the earthquake and tsunami would be fair. And they're an affluent society, but they have a much lower social gradient over society, and in fact they have a number of qualities that are different. Like there's very little obesity in Japan, for example,
that's right.
Which is unusual for a developed country. So, interested in your comments on that.
There is no data.
Mm.
And I would argue that there's a desperate need for international comparisons.
Yes. Mm.
But that work hasn't been done. I guess the fact that the work has been done in the US is partly due to US academics thinking to themselves, well, what the hell is going on here? Why are we behaving in this way? We need to look at this. We need to investigate this. Whereas in societies which are more... cohesive, like the Western European countries, because the problem doesn't exist so much, the desire to investigate it is...
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah, that's interesting. So please come to the microphone with a question.
Apart from the figures being largely self-evident, what do you put down to the position in the United States, in a broad brush political approach, where you tend to be, both camps are driven by a sense of can-do-ness, this manifest destiny, whereas the Australian thing, which is still based on apathy, like too hard, gee whiz, tomorrow's the weekend. And if you want to draw cross-references, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, with how people receive their information, dissemination of information, I think Adelaide would be an absolute prime target in a one-paper town. On a polling radio, the ABC lurching sideways and ever downward in its sort of pseudo-popularism because they've been lent on by the state government and things like that. So you have the worst, agreedly, the worst newspaper in the country. As my father, a former eminent journalist, would say, if I were a fish, I'd be ashamed to be wrapped in it. Which is a line almost worthy of Spike Milligan. But it's this sort of too hard basket, isn't it? You have radical, pseudo-radical Tony Abbott on one end of it, who's just, let's not kid ourselves, it's a blatant opportunist to argue about anything. And you have the other side, which is the captive to right-wing, pseudo-social democratic heavyweights. So where are we going to go?
I agree that we have a problem here. I think... I think that it would be desirable to do similar work here to get some insight into that, because... once you have the data, you can comment in a more informed way. But I suspect that you're right, and depending on the outcome of that work, you would get a
perhaps a different view about how to address the problem than might emerge from the US analysis. But the work needs to be done.
Firstly, thanks for a really interesting presentation. But I was interested in the brain scan research result that you quoted, and I'd heard about that before. But the results of that showed, you know, political affiliation and associated voting Republican and i.e. doing least about the environment. They associated that with high anxiety levels. Therefore, I kind of wondered how you would propose persuading people and motivating people to change the environment. You know, because it would, those results would suggest that increasing people's anxiety about the environment would actually lead to less action.
Yes, you're right that the use of fear would have to be handled very carefully. And one of the things which really emerges from the segmentation generally is that in constructing strategies to deal with the problem we have, we really need to segment the market or the target when designing our strategies. So we need to think about the characteristics of these half a dozen different categories and their patterns of gaining information, and develop our means of communication with them on the basis of that analysis. And in general, from my reading, the use of fear is something which has to be handled very carefully in this context, because the outcome can be totally counterproductive. But we need to do the work.
Any idea how to persuade the people who sort of, you know, the majority of people possibly who are just concerned about their own lifestyle suffering, you know, because it would if we do something serious about the environment?
For a start, you'd use people in communicating with them, as it comes out from this work, you would use people within their community and with whom they associated as the people who brought the message. You would break down the cultural barrier and build on the idea that people tend to believe what those of their identity group also believe. You basically work in that way to reduce the concern that people have about accepting a level, because they see that other people like them believe that, and more importantly perhaps that other people like them act in ways which are desirable in this particular context, like reducing their use of cars. It really emphasises again the need for leaders to exercise leadership in terms of their behaviour. And we're not actually seeing that.
Thanks very much.
Is there an age difference? I mean, because clearly the generations are going to be impacted very differently on this. And, you know, my generation probably has been the one that's caused it. And our children's and grandchildren's generations and beyond will be the ones who'll have to pay the highest price. I mean, is there a way of really trying to mobilise young people?
Yeah, well, I guess to a degree, Amanda McKenzie answered that question in the sense that she showed that she could mobilise young people. Again, she, as a young person, used approaches that were familiar to her age cohort to communicate with people within. Yes.
Mm. And I think that really is the future direction that we've got to go in. Please ask a question.
Something a bit different. I'm from Albury Wodong at the start of the Murray there, been fighting for a lot of changes in the Murray. They're threatening to do this, that and the other thing. But I've just been on a motorbike tour of this area up to Marlee, down to Port Lincoln. And the interesting thing was I fell off my motorbike up in the Bratchner Gorge and I was helped up by a professor, an elderly professor of some note. And he helped me with a cup of tea and whatever, got me back up. No, I didn't know what I was talking about. The climate change thing was too complex. How could I possibly know? And it was all whatever. Later in my travels, I came across a fisherman, an ordinary common fisherman. And he knew surprisingly not. We had a terrific discussion about it. And then in another caravan park, I came across a caretaker, an ordinary everyday caretaker. And he too spoke strongly about it. And to me, it was very surprising that I would have thought the opposite. Professional man would have understood it, and yes, it's good that you're concerned, but no, he brushed it aside, and the other two, who I would have thought I wouldn't know a lot about it, were good. But the other thing I'm going home with is in my long rides between the towns is I have time to think, and what worries me now more than climate change is the fact that we have climate change coming. We have the oil peak has passed and will change things greatly. And we have the world economy in an awful mess. And then, of course, there's population. All these things coming together over this time, the next 10 years are going to be, hugely dramatic or something or other. And no one's talking about it. It all puts me in mind of, is it the mayors or someone who said it was going to end at 2012? Not that I believe that, but cripes above, there's some big things happening, aren't they, that we really need to be discussing is that all these things seem to be coming together at this time. It's just strange, that's all. Things I think about.
A very interesting comment, thank you.
Yeah, well, certainly those problems you address are certainly all with us. And they're all big problems.
Any other points people would like to raise? Getting a bit... Ah, here we go, good.
Oh, hi there, everyone. I'd like to make a question about the sort of the typical psyche of Australians. They're traditionally known to be into beer, football and the beach, but it's not so at all. Apparently we work far more overtime than most Western nations. As a group, we seem to be so laid back that we're allowing a lot of imposition of action which are losing our freedoms because we're such a genial, nice society. Like retrospective laws, like you're deemed to be guilty unless you can prove you're innocent, like even little things like car fines, automotive fines, revenue raising. Also with these terrorist laws, a lot of them are terrible laws. Could I get a comment upon that as part of the Australian psyche and letting it happen, whereas if we're in France, they'd be throwing papers in the street if they were introducing the same laws there. Thank you.
I'm not sure that I feel qualified to respond to that. It's certainly true that people in Australia are more laid back about issues, and it's a fairly obvious corollary that such a society is going to be vulnerable to those in the political elite who want to impose draconian law. And frankly, I see that as happening. And the big question for Australian society is, well, are we prepared to roll over and see our society progressively become more uncaring, more draconian in the way it treats social problems? Frankly, I'm not prepared to, but I'm only one, and if we have this characteristic generally, somehow we've got to find a way around that. Perhaps we've got to... It may be that things have got to get particularly bad before people respond and take action. What you are seeing, I suppose, is that despite this laid-backness, a number of Labor governments in Australia have toppled and fallen very dramatically. Now, whether that was because, despite the population being laid back, eventually a tipping point in terms of how fed up they were with the state governments had been exceeded, and so people decided we've had enough. If that's the way it's going to work in Australia, then I don't think I'm not very. I don't regard that as a good outcome.
But I think you may well argue.
Can you speak into the microphone, please?
Maybe well argued that laid back and it's a cult is the ultimate form of reaction. And crypto conservative Australians are unbelievably reactionary and conservative. Those wonderful people here.
Not the people here, of course not.
Being the major champion. No, I mean, I sit on a couple of boards of admissions for people to get into various courses, and they're what you might call liberal arts, I think, in my visiting capacity, not as an academic or anything like that, but an industry, film and television industry-based person. And I find that people, especially the 18-year-olds, not the more mature age people, when I'm talking about 30-plus, I can say that because I'm right, but the younger people are incredibly reactionary and narrow. You know, you ask them, you know, sort of interesting, sort of like, gee whiz, I wonder what they think about this. They look at you like, why are you asking me the question? You know, is this going to be in the exam? Well, no, not really. Good. So why are you telling me? You know, I can't find this on Google, therefore it doesn't exist. What's this about? And then you have the other thing where people believe literally everything that's been put, because you know, it's in Spin City, isn't it? We live in Spin City. Half of this whole enterprise over the last 2 days has been spin and press release.
Thank you.
Well, I think you're pointing to something which we need to give more attention to. On the question of reactionism, young people being reactionary, maybe, this is just a randomly generated thought, maybe it's partly because of the media environment that we now have, and partly because young people nowadays seem to be entirely focused on their mobiles and are not receiving much in the way of input which would otherwise suggest a wider way of looking at society.
Or,
yeah.
Look, if you want to make a comment, please come to the microphone. Are there any other comments that anybody would like to make? Would you, John, like to make a final comment? Because we've just got a few minutes left now.
Well, I guess my plea, and this is something I'm trying to exercise through the academic realms, is for us to develop a capacity to understand ourselves, both by the development of departments of social inquiry that look into these issues, and to reinforce the academic disciplines which relate to this issue. That's my present focus.
Yeah, and I think it's a very important factor to recognise the social pressures which are moulding us and pushing us, rather than just, we aren't purely rational beings by any means. And so I think to understand those other drivers is extremely important. Look, I'd like for you to join me in thanking John for a very stimulating presentation.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.